From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the politics of cleaning with feminist, journalist, and author Barbara Ehrenreich. For a short time last year, Ehrenreich worked for a house cleaning service, cleaning the homes of affluent families. Her article about her house cleaning experience appears in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. Also, we talk about the mindset of athletes with sports psychiatrist Michael Miletic. As a psychiatric consultant to the Detroit Pistons and several pro hockey teams, he works one-on-one with pro athletes. Miletic says he's trying to develop a psychological map of the jock mind. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Monk's Dream, the new CD from saxophonist Steve Lacy and trombonist Roswell Rudd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Miami relatives of Elian Gonzalez have finished meeting with three mental health experts in a discussion intended to ease the boy's transition from their custody to the custody of his father. Officials at Miami's Mercy Hospital, where the meeting was held, say the 1 hour and 15-minute talk ended cordially but didn't give details of what was discussed. NPR's Philip Davis said the experts didn't interview the 6-year-old Cuban boy who's the focus of this custody battle.
The president of Mercy Hospital told us that Elian did not meet with the psychologist. So Elian had come to Mercy Hospital earlier in the afternoon to visit Mary Lacy's, who he's grown very close to in the past 5 months, because Mary Lacy's has almost acted as a surrogate mother to Elian, caring for the boy since he was rescued at sea nearly 5 months ago.
NPR's Philip Davis in Miami. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak is heading to Washington after talks in Cairo with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Egypt's foreign minister said Mideast peace was in crisis and added that something serious must be done on all fronts. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
After an hour-long meeting between Barak and Mubarak, neither leader spoke to the press. Egyptian Foreign Minister Amr Moussa said the obstacles to peace are even more serious than before, because the Palestinians and Israelis are supposed to be hammering out a final peace deal.
I wish to emphasize that we are at the 11th hour. It is not. We don't have enough time to waste.
Moussa expressed Egypt's hope that Barak's meeting with President Clinton will move talks towards a settlement based on land for peace. The Palestinians said they would suspend their talks if negotiations with the Israelis continue to produce no results. They've appealed to the Israeli peace movement to press Barak to conclude a peace deal by September to avoid conflict on the West Bank and Gaza. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
A Senate panel heard testimony today from people who say they were victimized by the so-called death care industry. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Senate Select Committee on Aging is holding 2 days of hearings on abuses in the funeral industry. One woman told of having to cremate her grandparents after embalming fluid leaked from her grandmother's casket.
My grandparents have been violated in their death. They no longer rest in peace in their family plot alongside their only child.
The panel also heard from a convicted felon who said the funeral industry benefits from people who prepay their burial expenses. Consumer groups say there are no national regulations for the funeral industry, and state rules vary widely, allowing such abuses to proliferate. Industry representatives will tell their side of the story Tuesday. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks today, the Nasdaq lost 258 points, or nearly 6%. To close at 4,188. This is NPR News. Today, President Clinton welcomed the decisions by North Korea and South Korea to hold a summit meeting in June. The meeting will be the first face-to-face contact between the leaders of the two sides since the Korean Peninsula was divided in 1945. Technology stocks took another nosedive today. The Nasdaq Composite Index dropped 258 points, its second biggest one-day point loss, to close at 41,088. NPR's Elaine Corey reports from San Francisco.
It was another Monday massacre for the technology sector. The Nasdaq Index dropped 5.8%, closing down 17% from its record high just a month ago. Decliners beat advancers by 2-1 as investors fled tech shares for so-called old economy holdings, such as industrial and financial stocks. Big losers included Qualcomm and JDS Uniphase. Microsoft, Nextel Communications, and Hewlett-Packard also closed off. The sell-off broke a three-day winning streak that pushed the Nasdaq up more than 7%. The chief market analyst at Merrill Lynch said in a report that the computer-related firms dominating the Nasdaq had begun an important corrective trend, the beginning of a long-lasting change. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.
The Dow gained 73 points today to close at 11,186 in heavy trading. Early returns from the local elections in Bosnia show hardline nationalist parties in the lead in many areas. The Serbian Nationalist Party, founded by Radovan Karadzic, did well in Serbian parts of the country, although the multi-ethnic Social Democratic Party did better than nationalist parties in the Muslim areas. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Have you noticed how many people hire house cleaners these days? According to MediaMark research, the number of households employing outside cleaning help has more than doubled in the last 5 years. The majority of these households use freelance housekeepers, but each year more people are turning to cleaning services such as Merry Maids, Molly Maids, Maid Brigade, and the Maids International. This boom in the international house cleaning industry caught the attention of social historian and journalist Barbara Ehrenreich. As part of her research for a book about low-wage workers, she got a job last year on a cleaning crew for the Maids International in Portland, Maine. Ehrenreich's books include Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class, and Complaints and Disorders, The Sexual Politics of Sickness. Her articles and essays have appeared in such publications as Time, Mother Jones, and the New York Times Magazine. She's also a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. Her article about her experience as a maid and her thoughts about the social ramifications of the burgeoning service industry is the cover story in this month's issue of Harper's. In it, she describes her typical workday. Starting at 7, she was assigned to a 4-person crew. They cleaned 5 houses a day, with barely time for a convenience store pit stop lunch. I asked her whether she thought, going into this, that she knew how to clean.
See, I thought, well, this will be easy, you know. I'm, you know, actually in real life a writer and a journalist, but, you know, I've cleaned my own house, always have. This is going to be easy. I know how to do it, right? Well, surprise. You know, you had to watch these training tapes to find out the system. And the system was incredibly precise, you know, that you, I'll never forget it. In fact, I think I'll have a hard time shaking it in my own house. You enter a room, you move from left to right. Well, first you divide the room mentally into these sections. And within each section, you also go from left to right and top to bottom. And you never vary from that. Also, the way you move between rooms is described quite precisely, and so there you don't have to do a lot of thinking beyond which cleaning fluid you might be using or you know, something like that.
And is the point of all that efficiency? To keep you from
time? That's what I was told by the boss. He said that, you know, this was all done on the basis of time motion studies. I actually, once I got over my resentment of this, was glad to have it because, you know, you when you're under a lot of time pressure, you might make a mistake. You might leave a spot out or you might redo something, which would be even more tragic, I think.
So how sanitary is it? How clean is a house after one of these, your teams was done with it?
Well, when we were done, it looked beautiful. I mean, every surface was shining. You know, it looked very nice. Now, I have my criticisms, though, of how actually sanitary any of these methods are. Very little water is used in the entire process, and I think this applies to the other large cleaning services, too. Most everything is cleaned with a damp rag. Now, That's really not going to do it. You know, when I got out of this situation and was full of curiosity about what I'd just experienced, I called some house cleaning experts, and they were fairly appalled. You know, because the goal with these cleaning services is really to make things look good. It's not to kill germs, you know, bacteria, viruses, anything like that. It's just to make things look good. So, for example, if you really want to get your kitchen counter clean, do you want to hear this, Barbara?
I think I've been through this before. You spray with a disinfectant, and you wait 3 or 4 minutes, and then you wipe it with a clean cloth.
But you don't, or you use a lot of hot soapy water or something. But you don't just wipe with a damp rag.
Well, you make the case in the article in Harper's that that this isn't a good thing. It's not a good trend. And regardless of whether you have a cleaning service or you hire a freelancer to clean your home, it's maybe not such a great thing. Why is that? I'm thinking as women return to the workplace, their time is worth more. Why do housework if it doesn't make financial sense, especially in a boom time when we're not thinking of saving the way our post-war parents thought about it? Why not spend the money paying someone to do something you don't want to do yourself?
Well, you know, there's a sort of a slippery slope on both sides of this argument. I mean, you can, you know, on the one hand, you know, you could say to me, well, and of course we're used to, you know, we're used to all kinds of low-paid people, you know, involved in food processing, stitching our clothes somewhere in the world. Why not this? But, you know, it's a slippery slope on the other side, too. As you start moving toward being a servant economy, which certainly the upper middle class and the upper class in this country have done, there are costs, I think, and not only to the relatively low-wage people who do the work. I think there are effects on the family that is waited on. The thing that would go through my mind so often when I was cleaning is, what about the children in this setting? You know, you'd walk into some teenager's room and maybe have to take 15 minutes to pick up the clothes and other debris on the floor before you could vacuum. And, of course, fold each one of those items very nicely. And you think, what's going on with this? Well, first you're producing a kid who is not going to be able to take care of themselves, you know, clearly, but is also has a pretty funny attitude toward the world, you know, who assumes that things that they mess up or dirty up will be taken care of by someone else. And I would not have been happy if my children had been raised or turned out to have that kind of contempt for other people's work. So that's one of the things.
So you see, this is a moral issue. There's a moral dimension in not cleaning your own mess.
But right, clean your own mess. That's my something I try to teach my kids. But another part of my reaction to this comes from having been involved in the feminist movement for 25 years or so, and our radical vision in the 1970s. Was not that some women were going to go out to work and have brilliant careers while some other women came in and did that tedious work for them, but that men and women were going to share the work of the home. You know, the man you're living with, boyfriend or husband, were going to share the work of the home, and that no woman, you know, no woman was going to get ahead in her career by depending on, you know, the relatively ignominious work of some other woman in the home.
I think it's interesting, though, that you point out that feminists such as Betty Friedan hailed hiring housekeepers as a big step in women's liberation, that it was demystifying the myth that housework is the woman's lot. So did she get it wrong?
Well, no, wait. How is she demystifying the idea that it's a woman's lot? Those house cleaners are not men, by and large. I mean, they're overwhelmingly female. What that says to me, though, about Betty Friedan's brand of feminism is something, well, it's been said many times before, is that she was really directing herself to the upper middle class, college-educated woman, and that her notion of the constituency for feminism did not include the potential cleaning person in that, mm-hmm. the cleaning woman. You know, it was all, hey, we can get ahead if we you know, get these cleaning women and don't even bother having the arguments with our husbands. And it doesn't say, well, what about her?
Where did the momentum go in that bonding of politics and housework? And you point out that in the 60s and the 70s, there was the movement wages for housework. And being a feminist practically meant that you fought with a male partner or your housemates about sharing the housework. And that's all faded out.
I don't know. This is a very vexing question. There's some interesting data from a big University of Maryland study, which was reported, I think, last fall. And they really examined the division of housework between men and women in the home. And they found, yes, indeed, men have taken up more work than they used to do. You know, between 1965 and the mid-90s, there is some, you know, some more equality between the sexes in the home. But that trend toward men doing more just seems to stop in the mid-80s. You know, as if, men suddenly said, that's it, that's all I'm doing. or the woman decided, I'm not going to have this fight anymore. You know, I'm going to, and there was, by the mid-80s, much less of a on-the-ground, grassroots feminist movement that was going to provide you psychological support in that fight at home.
I just want to get back to this idea that, it's impossible to remain pure in all areas of your life. I mean, I don't make my own soap or my own cheese. Not only do I not sew my own clothes, I sometimes buy clothes at the Gap, say, or I buy my clothes there. Why draw the line at housework?
I'm not, the point of this article of mine in Harper's was not to say, hey, fire your maid and do it yourself. It was to say something about the conditions of this kind of work, especially in the cleaning services that are taking over. Just as we have sought to understand who's making our jeans, and I confess to buying from the Gap too, and how can we pressure that company to do better, to stop with the, getting the sweatshop clothes. I think we need to know more about the people who do all kinds of work around us, even when the information is painful. And, some people, I think, probably do treat their independent freelance cleaning person very well. At least many of the people I talk to claim they just pay extravagantly and are, friends with this person. But I think the people who use these cleaning services should know what kind of conditions, should know that in effect, let me put it very baldly, that in some sense their home doubles as a sweatshop during the day.
My guest is Barbara Ehrenreich. She's the author of a number of books of social history and intellectual analysis. She is also a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, and we're talking about her article, her cover story in this month's issue of Harper's. It's called Made to Order, The Politics of Other Women's Work. Barbara, we're going to take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is social historian Barbara Ehrenreich. She has an article in this month's Harper Magazine about the politics of housework. It's called Made to Order. Okay, in the spirit of full disclosure, after my second child was born, I hired a young couple to clean my house every 2 weeks. And I find that I make all of these really arbitrary distinctions about what I think it's okay for them to do for me. For instance, I and the kids straighten up the house like crazy before they come. Some part of my brain just thinks it's not okay for people to pick up after me, but it is all right for them to do heavy cleaning, as if that's a professional skill they have. Now, do you find these kinds of conflicted feelings come up when you talk to people about their hiring cleaning help?
Yes. What I didn't make a point of systematically interviewing employers of cleaning people, but when I have informally talked to friends who do, I think there's a lot of anxiety and guilt around this issue, and unfortunately more in the women than the men when they talk about it. I mean, if there's any anxiety and guilt, it should be both men and women who share it. And yeah, so I think that part of that lingers from the huge debates we had about housework in the 70s And the idea then that housework was this form of labor that united all women, right, except for the very, very richest, because we all did it. You know, there is some tension.
I do keep reading about women, I guess, and some men screaming at the help during dinner parties in front of guests. That seems to be a favorite lead in the New York Times.
Yes, I read the same story.
Yeah, that the nouveau riche doesn't know how to treat the help.
Yeah, no, that's really appalling. Now, I never ran into anything like that in my short life as a maid, although there were cases of rudeness, what I could only call great rudeness and indifference. For example, we, for some reason that beats me, management did not allow us to ever drink anything while we were working. Now, this was an extreme hardship. Part of the time I was working, it was still very hot, end of August. And I said, what, can't I bring my bottled water, you know? Hey, we yuppies always have our bottled water. You can't take that from me in 90-degree heat.
Why? Is this because on the surveillance camera, the hidden surveillance camera, it might look like you're swilling gin?
I really can't imagine the rationale. It's some demented idea of professionalism. You know, that if you're a profession, you have no physical needs of your own. So, you know, I kept hoping someone would offer me a glass of water, and my coworkers too, if I was feeling generous about it, on these very hot days. Because, you know, I would be just pouring sweat. This is much worse than gym sweat. This was, you know, I could wring out my ponytail. I could wring out my braid. I was sweating that much. Only one time did anybody offer me a glass of water. And I was just like absurdly grateful to this woman. You know, but they'd walk by with their iced tea or whatever, and, you know, they'd never think about this person or people in front of them who were just drenched in sweat on their hands and knees on the floor to say, like, some water, and forget about coffee or anything in this story.
I guess that's part of the allure of these cleaning services, that you don't actually deal with the people who are cleaning your home. I mean, you see them in your home, but your relationship is with the manager of the service, right? If you
yeah,
have any
and the
complaints,
manager
you go
is
to
likely
them.
To be a middle-class white person, so you don't feel you have to deal across any gap of class and race. I mean, it sort of bothers me how uncurious of the employers, the people who use these services are. For example, the one I worked with charged its customers, the homeowners, $25 per person hour. That means the company was paid $25 for every hour I worked for $6 an hour and change. Now, you'd think, you know, somebody would ask, hey, by the way, for the money I'm paying you, the boss, what are you paying the women who work for you? Or how come they don't get a break in long 3 hours? How come I've never seen any of them even run out to the car to get a drink of water? No questions.
Cleaning really is just one example of outsourcing in the home. There are all sorts of services people are using right now: personal online assistants, personal dressers, dinner delivery, landscapers. These are all kind of the high-end personal assistants, service contractors. But I'm curious what you think the side effects are from this trend of people not really taking care of the daily tasks of life and not really learning how to take pleasure from the daily tasks of life, like walking your own dog or, you know, cooking your meals or gardening.
It's part of what looks to me like a kind of frenzy. The upper middle class, or maybe the upper 15-20% of the population, is involved in. They work very hard. They work too hard. It's more than that, though. It's not just that they have a lot of work to do, but it's important if you're in that class to look busy. You know, this is kind of sick, that busyness becomes a mark of social status. You know, historically, if you go back, you know, through the centuries, leisure was the status insignia of the very powerful and rich. We've strangely inverted that. And, I mean, one of the things that I think that's sort of nice about doing housework, and I'm not going to romanticize it. Some critic called me the Martha Stewart of the left, so I'm pretty careful about this.
Ouch. You know?
Yeah. This critic never saw my house, obviously. But it's not that it's a great psychological thing to clean a bathroom floor. But I think that what we lose is, for example, is ways of interacting with family members that are sort of natural, that are around doing something else. You know, I know as a mother, you're not going to have a very interesting conversation with a child by putting her down and, you know, sitting her down in the kitchen with some cookies after school and saying, well, how was school today? You know, nothing comes of that. But what I found worked for me much better as a mother, and I had to do it anyway, was, hey, look, you want to put these clothes away? You know, why don't we do this together? And then you're not, like, focusing on that child as if he or she were some kind of, you know, it was what you were working on. She's not an object of your work. The two of you are working on something else, and that's when there's a kind of a calm and ordinary conversation with maybe some very interesting revelations about what's going on with the child.
Well, that's exactly right. There's such an interesting shift in parenting going on. It used to be that your kids were around while you did your work at home, and they joined in and they learned things. And if parents aren't doing that anymore with their kids, the time ends up becoming all about exactly the child, or about academics at best, about reading, or at worst, TV. The time is just something that you fill, that you don't share together in some meaningful way.
Right, and I think this helps transmit that kind of frenzy, that kind of high-pressure approach to life down to the kids, because they don't see anybody of their social class, actually doing some physical labor or anything like that. They feel that there's all this pressure on them to achieve, to do terrifically in the SATs or soccer or whatever else.
Right, not to enjoy things just for their own sake.
Yeah. Or even when it's not enjoying it, I mean, an enjoyable sort of thing, even when it's a matter of this is something that has to get done, it's sort of, you know, it can be slow, it can be tedious, but we're doing it together. And that makes all the difference in the world.
Well, Barbara Ehrenreich, I want to thank you very much for talking today. That was fun.
I enjoyed it.
Barbara Ehrenreich is an author, essayist, and a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. Her article about the politics of house cleaning appears in the current issue of the magazine. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of a variety of seeds, plants, home furnishings, tools, and other gardening products. And from Random House's Delta Division, publisher of The Times of My Life and My Life with the Times by Max Frankel of The New York Times. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the psyche of the pro athlete. We talk with sports psychiatrist Michael Miletic. And Kevin Whitehead reviews Monk's Dream, a new CD from Steve Lacy and Roswell Rudd. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. There's perhaps no other profession in which the mind-body connection is as crucial as it is in sports. Many professional teams have a psychologist on staff, but the field of sports psychology is mostly geared toward quick-fix behavioral therapy and performance enhancement. Dr. Michael Miletic takes a different approach. He's a former athlete who's now a psychiatrist, and he's one of the few mental health workers in sports who practices psychoanalysis. Dr. Miletic may spend years with a patient, slowly exploring their past, identifying the traumas that may have led to their current distress. Miletic has been a psychiatric consultant to the parents group of the National Football League Players Association, to several National Hockey League teams, and to the Detroit Pistons. He says he's developing a psychological map of the jock's mind. When we talked last week, Miletic told me about the first professional athlete he worked with.
It happened shortly after my residency in psychiatry in Detroit, where I was called to the bedside in an intensive care unit of a National Hockey League player who had attempted suicide by swallowing a combination of antidepressants and sedatives and other barbiturates in a very serious suicide attempt. And I was called in by the family to consult with this very unfortunate and in fact, life-threatening situation at the time, with the story and history that this was a man that had been spinning out of control for some time and had unexpectedly, to everyone, attempted to take his life as a way to get out of something that felt inescapable to him in his life.
Now, one of his biggest problems was that he had a signature slap shot, and he suddenly wasn't able to hit it, right?
That's true. And that, in fact, was an early part of what he felt to be his decline on the ice, and he felt that this was a signature is a good word because he was known throughout the league as having one of the most powerful shots and able to deliver it virtually on target each time. Symptomatic of some of his problems was the fact that he was unable to hit the net with the same degree of accuracy or any accuracy at all earlier on in the course of his decline.
Now, in your treatment of him, did you work on regaining this key to his game, his slap shot?
There was not a focusing on particular symptoms with this man that I began with, at least. In fact, I began by trying to open up any potential and any possibility of talking about anything with him, rather than focusing on particular symptoms. Instead of focus on symptoms, which I was concerned might narrow the field of his mind, instead we approached it from a point of view of let's open up the field and see just what we can find as much as possible.
After 2 years, you did have a breakthrough in therapy with this this hockey player. How did the breakthrough come about?
Breakthrough, I think, was happening more in my mind than in what was going on between us, because things had moved quite slowly. I just sort of continued the same approach of non-symptom oriented self reflection and discussion and interaction between the two of us. And what we stumbled upon in probably a year and a half later was a very traumatic history that this young man had endured. A traumatic history consisting of his being ritually beaten, either with a belt or with some other instrument by both an uncle and a father, when he was seen as being bad around the house. These memories emerged without much emotion, without much affect attached to them, were given very little significance by him at the beginning, were seen as something both familial and cultural, and so what's the big deal? What's there to think about or talk about? But what I did was to begin to gradually explore the meaning of these beatings to him, and what was very clear to me was that as he would begin to discuss how he was beaten and taken through the different moments of these terrible times to him, he would link them in his mind to his hockey. And particularly what he began to do was to link them temporally to thinking about his slap shot and thinking about collisions and thinking about shooting the puck from the blue line. And what I began to think about was the possibility that this man was experiencing something of a jargon term which doesn't exactly capture the experience, but something of a subliminal emotional flashback, that as he was shooting, he was connecting somehow the act of shooting a puck with being beaten.
What does that mean to link an emotion, a long past trauma, to something happening now, to his hockey game? He would link them in the same sentence, or he'd switch ideas? What do you mean, link?
The word link takes a lot of different forms, and in this case, with this patient, he would begin to suddenly and abruptly change topic and begin to speak about some of these abusive practices after he was talking about the symptom of shooting the puck and of what it felt like to be on the ice shooting the puck. I would focus him in at times on the emotion that he might be feeling as he was winding up to shoot the puck, and he would blank out or stop abruptly in the middle of talking about this. I would ask him, you know, what's happening? What's coming into your head right now? And then he would begin to talk about some of the beatings that had occurred. And what I began to realize was that when he began to feel in my room with me the anxiety connected with shooting a puck, it reminded him of the same anxieties that he would feel when being approached by his father about to be hit.
So once you established this association, or you started digging up this association, did his game improve?
His game began to improve slowly and gradually at first, but in something of fits and starts. Now, what was happening by this time was that he would return to the ice, return to the game, and begin to shoot, and become more aware that he would be beginning to face these kinds of anxieties, that instead of talking to him about suppressing or pushing away at the moment of the game, I was inviting him to allow himself to feel the anxiety that would be coming up, to get more comfortable with the anxiety, in a sense, that would naturally be coming up for him. And then he would either be successful or unsuccessful, somewhat sporadically, and then he would come back in to sessions or telephone me afterwards and talk to me more about what his experience was like. And so in deepening ways, we began to uncover and understand more and more deeply about what was happening with him emotionally as he was in the middle of playing hockey, and how much of this would of the particular experience connected with and correlated with earlier past experiences, so that once enough work was done, he didn't have to think anymore. He went back to being able to feel just in the flow of the game itself, and things became automatic for him again, and he once again reacquired the shot that had been missing from him.
I'm thinking that what's so different about what you do is that it's psychoanalysis. I mean, in the general cliche of sports psychology, analysis equals paralysis. Just do it. You know, don't think too much. Right? You're supposed to be helping athletes sustain the flow of their game. Do you have to fight that?
Actually, that's one of the larger misconceptions about modern psychoanalysis, that it involves overthinking. What I'm essentially trying to do is to remove the obstacles, the emotional obstacles, from an athlete patient that are getting in the way of him being able to be in the flow of the game without thinking. Mm. So, in fact, I would think that what I'm doing differently is instead of saying to the athlete, just consciously suppress any kind of negative emotion, I'm saying, let's open it up. Let's learn, understand, and think about in as much depth as we can what the impeding emotions are so that you can return and be even freer. Because this way has a more likely way of being able to really help you deal automatically with those impediments without worrying about consciously suppressing something that you might not be able to.
Have you treated many athletes who can no longer do their signature shot or move, as was the case with this athlete, make the slap shot or dunk the basketball or throw a strike?
That's one of the major symptoms that people will come to me with. Right. Part of what I'm thinking of, how I'm thinking about these kinds of things, is that an athlete has particularly enhanced capacities to what I call dissociate himself or herself from his or her life in general. An athlete goes out into the court or onto the playing field and is not immersed emotionally or cognitively in the thinking about day-to-day life events, family, kids, investments in today's world, endorsements, and so on. An athlete that's performing successfully can block all of that out almost automatically, but if not, can be helped to be trained to block things out automatically, to feel in the flow of the game. And my experience has been that what's happening with these, with certain higher skilled athletes and professional athletes, that they, for some reason, lose the capacity and the ability to do that, to do something that helps them dissociate from the rest of their life in a way that helps them be in the flow. And this isn't only, I'm finding, limited to athletes, but it's also certain other people that are in high-pressure jobs, business CEOs, entrepreneurial types, surgeons, people that require that sort of intense focus and almost being lost in what they're doing. And when people feel like they're losing their edge, my experience has been that something is happening unconsciously that they're not fully aware of, that's coming up in what I call bad dissociative ways, so that they can't concentrate, can't be in the flow, feel fogged out, feel blank, like they're blanking out, feel like they've lost their aggressive edge. Something's happening in their mind to interfere with the ability to dissociate well.
I'm curious how much your patients talk with you about superstitiousness, or admit to it, or find it a problem.
It's a large part of a player's repertoire. I think that prior to and leading up to a game can be a very potentially frightening emotional experience that a player will experience as excitement or experience as jitters or butterflies or something of that sort. But what they're feeling is a sense of vulnerability. They're feeling a sense of fear, and they're feeling a sense of an out-of-controlness that they need to somehow reestablish control over. And superstitions are often obsessive rituals or functions designed to help them feel more in control of the things that they're feeling most out of control of at that moment. The place where that gets to be a problem is when the defense itself, when the superstition or when the obsessive ritual itself begins to interfere with the preparation or the playing of the game.
So can you give us an example from your recent practice?
a hockey goalie will come in at a very specific and particular time. He has to be the first one in. He feels a mounting sense of tension, nausea, anxiety, and excitement as he gets closer to the rink. He spreads out his equipment in a particular way, puts on his left sock before his right sock, puts on his right pad before his left pad. Everything is done in a particular sequence and in a particular order, and he pats himself and checks his equipment in exactly the precise order that he needs to do before each, he can go out comfortably before each game begins. That's one of the milder ones that is probably pretty much known and well-known commonly. Once he's out on the ice, there's a team ritual after the warm-up then of certain and specific individuals just before the puck drops having to be in a particular order in front of him to pat him on the pads before they return back to the bench or to the face-off circle, so that it's not only a ritual that involves the goalie, but the goalie involves the other teammates in the same ritual.
Is everyone okay with this?
Very cool with it.
My guest is Michael Miletic. He's a psychoanalyst who specializes in treating professional and elite amateur athletes. He's been a psychiatric consultant to several NHL teams and the Detroit Pistons. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with psychoanalyst Michael Miletic. He specializes in treating professional and amateur athletes. Let's talk about a specific case in hockey, and I'm thinking of the recent example of Marty McSorley. He's the Boston Bruins defenseman who's accused of assault for slashing a Vancouver player in the head with his stick during a game. This is McSorley, a player whose specialty really was his or is his aggressiveness. He's used strategically by his coach, by his team, in that way. McSorley claims that what he did this night in question in February was no different than what he does almost every game. And it's raised questions about excessive aggressiveness, specifically in hockey, but throughout professional sports, and raises the question where you draw the line. Once you're in the zone, in the game, are there different rules that apply than would off the ice?
Well, your question covers a lot of different areas, from a legal to an ethical to a psychological one, so it's difficult to know where to begin with that one.
What are your impressions? What are your impressions of the case?
Well, my sense, I didn't hear the quote that you just mentioned, that this is something he does no different from anything else that he does in any game, because from my reading, at least, of a number of quotes, he had been deeply apologetic and felt that this had been out of character for him in some way, as far as his explanation went, that a premeditated attack such as this was something that he felt out of control of, and what he thought was not part of his usual aggressive game. Now, I had not spoken with him, nor have I spoken with people close to him, so I can't know for sure. But my sense of putting things together and putting the events together as I understood them and followed them had to do with his feeling earlier on both beaten up physically in the fight, but I think even more importantly, in terms of what might have provoked this kind of egregious act, was that he was taunted by the player that had beaten him up.
Are you often in the position then of, and I would imagine it's a difficult balancing act, of treating athletes like McSorley in a sport, hockey, in which the norm of aggressiveness really is not normal. The norm is not the norm of the streets, but of the rink. How do you help them channel the aggressiveness or find boundaries on the rink to help them control themselves, to find a line that they're comfortable with?
Well, I think that's an important question, because the entire game depends on that. The players were outraged that McSorley had broken the rules of the game. His act diminished the game in the public's eyes. It wasn't seen as an isolated, out-of-control act by somebody who was momentarily troubled. It was seen as an indictment of the game. So, first of all, the need to establish these kind of boundaries is essential for the players, for the sport, and for all of us watching the sport.
Well, what do the hockey players that you treat How do they talk about their moments on the rink? Because they're let loose to follow their instincts, to be in the game, not to constantly be monitoring their aggressiveness.
They're let loose to do that, and they, in fact, have to be able to channel that aggressiveness in order to perform and function well, which makes it an even trickier question and a trickier problem. But at the same time, a part of them has to be able to have some sense of boundary or control about themselves, in the same way that the playing field has lines drawn around the border of it, and in the same way that there are boards around the rink. They have to be fully in the flow of the game and in the moment of the game, but a part of them has to also be functioning as ready to take signals from themselves when they feel like they're crossing those lines. And for players that I treat, I, by necessity, who have difficulty in maintaining those boundaries, we have to get to the reasons why. What happens at those moments that they lose that capacity, that mental capacity to stay within the limits of the game?
Michael Miletic, I'd like to thank you very much for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Michael Miletic is a psychiatrist in private practice specializing in treating athletes. He's the psychiatric consultant to the Detroit Pistons and other pro teams as well. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD from Steve Lacy and Roswell Rudd. This is Fresh Air. Steve Lacy is a pioneer of the soprano saxophone in modern jazz, who tours the world from Paris and makes a lot of records. Roswell Rudd is a trombonist living in Woodstock, who had hardly toured or recorded at all since the Carter administration until he returned to active duty in the mid-90s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Lacy and Rudd have one of the greatest partnerships in jazz, even though they hardly ever play together. Their new album is only their fourth in the 40 years since they first teamed up. Kevin says the old magic is still there.
Steve Lacy and Roswell Rudd on Thelonious Monk's Pannonica. Lacy and Rudd had a band in the early 60s that only played Monk tunes. His music is piano-oriented, but their quartet had no piano. To compensate, they got in the habit of filling in behind each other's solos, to sketch the form or suggest a background or offer encouragement or support. Lucky for us, they slide back into the habit whenever they find themselves without a pianist. That's the case on their new CD, Monk's Dream, with Lacy's excellent rhythm section, bassist Jean-Jacques Avenel and drummer John Betch. Listen to how Lacy sneaks in behind Rudd on a blues at a perfect moment. There's something beautiful about that odd couple combination. Trombonist Rudd's blasts and bluster versus saxophonist Lacey's cool elegance. In the 60s, some modernists stressed the connection between free jazz and early jazz because both featured collective improvising by the horns. Unlike most modernists, Steve Lacy and Roswell Rudd had played a lot of Dixieland gigs and knew that collective improvising there is no free-for-all, but observes a hierarchy of lead and supporting voices. When Rudd and Lacy play together, they may shift discreetly between foreground and background roles. Call it New Orleans counterpoint. I wish more horn players showed the gumption of these fellas, stepping in each other's way like that. Many musicians consider it bad form to comment while another soloist has the floor, including some musicians bored by endless strings of isolated solos. Rudd excels at such kibitzing, and as usual, he brings out Lacey's earthy side. But Lacey set the mood by bringing along some nice tunes by Lacey, Monk, and Ellington. Roswell Rudd doesn't sound bad here by a long shot, but he's not in absolute top form, and some Steve Lacy fans will not cheer the presence of his longtime singer Irene Abey on two cuts. The CD Monk's Dream isn't the equal of Lacy and Rudd's classics School Days and Trickles. Yeah, so? Are they obliged to top themselves? No. Is this music plenty good as it stands? You already know the answer is yes.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Marie Baldonado directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Lamb in Love by Carrie Brown. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the new controversial TV show, Wonderland, with the show's creator, Peter Berg. Berg is an actor turned writer, director, and producer. Wonderland, a drama set in a mental hospital, is based on New York's Bellevue Hospital. Join us for the next Fresh Air.